This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interest of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome to Extraordinary Tales, a production of Audio Journal, bringing you fiction and nonfiction short stories. Today, Extraordinary Tales brings you an hour of short stories, originally aired on North Texas Radio of the Blind in Dallas. Enjoy.
Welcome back to an hour of short stories. I'm your host and narrator, John Pritchett. Today's program begins with works by two 20th century contemporary women authors. Irish Mary Lavin and American Catherine Ann Porter both endured difficult lives. Lavin was widowed twice and Porter divorced four times. Our third author is American humorist Ian Frazier. Born in 1951, he is still writing. Noted short story author Mary Lavin was born in Massachusetts in 1912 to Irish immigrants and lived in America until age 10 when her parents returned to Ireland. She published her first short story in 1938, and Atlantic Monthly serialized her first novel, The House on Clue Street, before it was published in 1945. Widowed in 1954, Mary reared three daughters while continuing her already well-established literary career. Several of her stories deal with widowhood, including the following one, which we have chosen for today, The Story of the Widow's Son. Married and widowed a second time, Mary died in an Irish nursing home in 1996. This is the story of a widow's son, but it is a story that has two endings. There once was a widow living in a small neglected village at the foot of a steep hill. She had only one son, but he was the meaning of her life. She lived for his sake. She wore herself out working for him. Every day she made 100 sacrifices in order to keep him at a good school in the town, 4 miles away, because there was a better teacher there than the village duller that had taught herself. She had made great plans for Packy, but she did not tell him about her plans. Instead, she threatened him day and night that if he didn't turn out well, she would put him to work on the roads or in the quarry under the hill. But as the years went by, everyone in the village, and even Packy himself, could tell by the way she watched him out of sight in the morning and watched to see him come into sight in the evening, that he was the beat of her heart and that her gruff words were only a cover for the pride and her joy in him. It was for Packy's sake that she walked for hours along the road, letting her cow graze the long acre of the wayside grass, in order to spare the few poor blades that pushed up through the stones in her own field. It was for his sake that she walked back and forth to the town to sell a few cabbages as soon as ever they were fit. It was for his sake that she got up in the cold dawning hours to gather mushrooms that would take the place of foods that had to be bought with money. She bent her back daily to make every penny she could, and, as often happens, she made more by industry out of her few bald acres than many farmers around her made out of their great bearded meadows. Out of the money she made by selling eggs alone, she paid for Packy's clothes and for a great number of his books. When Packy was 14, he was in the last class in the school, and the master had great hopes of his winning a scholarship to a big college in the city. He was getting to be a tall lad, and his features were beginning to take a strong cast. His character was strengthening, too, under his mother's sharp tongue. The people of the village were beginning to give to him the same respect they gave to the sons of the farmers who came from their fine colleges in the summer with blue suits and bright ties. One day in June, when the air was so heavy, the scent that rose up from the grass was imprisoned under the low clouds and hung in the air. The widow was waiting at the gate for Packy. There had been no rain for some days, and the hens and chickens were pecking irritably at the dry ground and wandering up and down the road in bewilderment. A neighbor passed. "Waiting for Packy?" said the neighbor pleasantly. He stood for a minute to take off his hat and wipe the sweat of the day from his face. He was an old man. "It's a hot day," he said. "It would be a hard push for Packy on that battered old bike of his. I wouldn't like to have to face into 4 miles on a day like this." "Packy would travel 3 times that distance if there was a book at the other end of the road," said the widow, with the pride of those who cannot read more than a line or two without wearying. The minutes went by slowly. The widow kept looking up at the sun. "I suppose the heat is better than the rain," she said at last. "The heat can do a lot of harm, too, though," said the neighbor absent-mindedly as he pulled a long blade of grass from between the stones of the wall and began to chew the end of it. "You could get a sunstroke on a day like this." He looked up at the sun. "The sun is a terror," he said. "It could cause you to drop down dead like a stone." The widow strained out farther over the gate. She looked up the hill in the direction of the town. "He will have a good breeze on his face coming down the hill at any rate," she said. The man looked up the hill. "That's true. On the hottest day of the year you would get a good breeze coming down that hill on a bicycle. You would feel the air streaming past your cheeks like silk. And in the winter, it's like 2 knives flashing to either side of you and peeling off your skin like you peel the bark off a willow rod." He chewed the grass meditatively. "That must be one of the steepest hills in Ireland," he said. "That hill is a hill worthy of the name of a hill." He took the grass out of his mouth. "It's my belief," he said earnestly, looking at the widow, "it is my belief that that hill is to be found marked with a name in the ordnance survey map." "If that's the case," said the widow, "Packy will be able to tell you all about it. When it isn't a book in his hand, it's a map." "Is that so?" said the man. "That's interesting. A map is a great thing. A map is not an ordinary thing. It isn't everyone can make out a map." The widow wasn't listening. "I think I see Packy," she said, and she opened the wooden gate and stepped out into the roadway. At the top of the hill there was a glitter of spokes as a bicycle came into sight. Then there was a flash of blue jersey as Packy came flying downward, gripping the handlebars of the bike with his bright hair blown back from his forehead. The hill was so steep, and he came down so fast, that it seemed to the man and woman at the bottom of the hill that he was not moving at all, but that it was the bright trees and bushes, the bright ditches and the wayside grasses that was streaming away to either side of him. The hens and chickens clucked and squawked and ran along the road looking for a safe place in the ditches. They ran to either side with feminine fuss and chatter. Packy waved to his mother. He came nearer and nearer. They could see the freckles on his face. "Shoo!" cried Packy at the squawking hens that had not yet left the roadway. They ran with their long necks straining forward. "Shoo!" said Packy's mother, lifting her apron and flapping it in the air to frighten them out of his way. It was only afterward, when the harm was done, that the widow began to think that it might, perhaps, have been the flapping of her own apron that frightened the old clocking hen and sent her flying out over the garden wall into the middle of the road. The old hen appeared suddenly on top of the grassy ditch and looked with a distraught eye at the hens and chickens as they ran to right and left. Her own feathers began to stand out from her. She craned her neck forward and gave a distracted squawk and fluttered down into the middle of the hot, dusty road. Packy jammed on the brakes. The widow screamed. There was a flurry of white feathers and a spurt of blood. The bicycle swerved and fell. Packy was thrown over the handlebars. It was such a simple accident that, although the widow screamed, and although the old man looked around to see if there was help near, neither of them thought that Packy was very badly hurt. But when they ran over and lifted his head and saw that he could not speak, they wiped the blood from his face and looked around desperately to measure the distance they would have to carry him. It was only a few yards to the door of the cottage, but Packy was dead before they got him across the threshold. "He's only in a weakness," screamed the widow, and she urged the crowd that had gathered outside the door to do something for him. Get a doctor, she cried, pushing a young laborer toward the door. Hurry, hurry, the doctor will bring him around. But the neighbors that kept coming in the door, quickly from all sides, were crossing themselves one after another and falling on their knees as soon as they laid eyes on the boy, stretched out flat on the bed, with the dust and dirt and the sweat marks of life on his dead face. When at last the widow was convinced that her son was dead, the other women had to hold her down. She waved her arms and cried out and wrestled to get free. She wanted to wring the neck of every hen in the yard. I'll kill every one of them. What good are they to me now? All the hens in the world aren't worth one drop of human blood. That old clocking hen wasn't worth more than 6 shillings at the very most. What is 6 shillings? Is it worth poor Packy's life? But after a time she stopped raving and looked from one face to another. Why didn't he ride over the old hen? She asked. Why did he try to save an old hen that wasn't worth more than 6 shillings? Didn't he know he was worth more to his mother than an old hen that would be going into the pot one of these days? Why did he do it? Why? Why? The neighbors patted her arm. There now! There now! They said. There now! And that was all they could think of saying. And they said it over and over again. And years afterward, whenever the widow spoke of her son Packy to the neighbors who dropped in to keep her company for an hour or two, she always had the same question to ask, the same tireless question. Why did he put the price of an old clocking hen above the price of his own life? And the people always gave the same answer. There now, they said. There now. And they sat as silently as the widow herself, looking into the fire. But surely some of those neighbors must have been stirred to wonder what would have happened had Packy not yielded to his impulse of fear, and had, instead, ridden boldly over the old clocking hen. And surely some of them must have stared into the flames and pictured the scene of the accident again, altering a detail here and there as they did so, and giving the story a different end. For these people knew the widow, and they knew Packy, and when you know people well, it is easy to guess what they would say and do in certain circumstances, as it is to remember what they actually did say and do in other circumstances. In fact, it is sometimes easier to invent rather than remember accurately, and were this not so, 2 great branches of creative art would wither in an hour, the art of the storyteller and the art of the gossip. So perhaps if I try to tell you what I think might have happened had Packy killed that cackling old hen, you will not accuse me of abusing my privilege as a writer. After all, what I am about to tell you is no more of a fiction than what I have already told, and I lean no heavier now upon your credulity than, with your full consent, I did in the first instance. And moreover, in many respects, the new story is the same as the old. It begins in the same way, too. There is the widow grazing her cow by the wayside and walking the long roads to town, weighted down with sacks of cabbages that will pay for Packy's schooling. There she is, fussing over Packy in the morning in case he would be late for school. There she is in the evening, watching the battered clock on the dresser for the hour when he will appear on the top of the hill at his return. And there, too, on a hot day in June, is the old laboring man coming up the road and pausing to talk to her as she stood at the door. There he is, dragging a blade of grass from between the stones of the wall and putting it between his teeth to chew before he opens his mouth. And when he opens his mouth at last, it is to utter the same remark. "Waiting for Packy?" said the old man, and then he took off his hat and wiped the sweat from his forehead. It will be remembered that he is an old man. "It's a hot day," he said. "It's very hot," said the widow, looking anxiously up the hill. "It's a hot day to push a bicycle 4 miles along a bad road with the dust rising to choke you and sun striking spikes off the handlebars." "The heat is better than the rain all the same," said the man. "I suppose it is," said the widow. "All the same, there were days when Packy came home with the rain dried into his clothes, so bad they stood up like stiff boards when he took them off." "Is that so?" said the old man. You may be sure he got a good petting in those days. There is no son like a widow's son, a ewe lamb.
Is it Packy? Said the widow in disgust. Packy's never got a day's petting since the day he was born. I made up my mind from the first that I'd never make a soft one out of him.
The widow looked up the hill again, and setting herself to raking the gravel outside the gate, as if she were in the road for no other purpose, then she gave another look up the hill.
"Here he is now,"
she said, and she rose such a cloud of dust with the rake that they could hardly see the glitter of the bicycle spokes and the flash of blue jersey as Packy came down the hill at breakneck speed. Nearer and nearer he came, faster and faster, waving his hand to the widow, shouting to the hens to leave the way. The hens ran for the ditches, stretching their necks in gawky terror, and then, as the last hen squawked into the ditch, the way was clear for a moment before the whirling silver spokes. Then, unexpectedly, up from nowhere it seemed, came an old clucking hen, and clucking despairingly. It stood for a moment on top of the wall and then rose into the air with the clumsy flight of a ground fowl. Packy stopped whistling. The widow screamed. Packy yelled and the widow flapped her apron. Then Packy swerved the bicycle and a cloud of dust rose from the braked wheel. For a minute it could not be seen what exactly had happened, but Packy put his foot down and dragged it along the ground in the dust till he brought the bicycle to a sharp stop. He threw the bicycle down with a clatter on the hard road and ran back. The widow could not bear to look. She threw her apron over her head.
"He's killed a clucking hen," she said. "He's killed her. He's killed her."
And then she let the apron fall back into place and began to run up the hill herself. The old man spat out the blade of grass that he had been chewing and ran after the woman.
"Did you kill it?" screamed the widow.
And as she got near enough to see the blood and feathers, she raised her arm over her head, and her fist was clenched till the knuckles shone white. Packy cowered down over the carcass of the fowl and hunched up his shoulders as if to shield himself from a blow. His legs were spattered with blood, and the brown and white feathers of the dead hen were stuck to his hands and stuck to his clothes, and they were strewn all over the road. Some of the short white inner feathers were still swirling with dust in the air.
"I couldn't help it, Mother. I couldn't help it. I didn't see her till it was too late."
The widow caught up the hen and examined it all over, holding it by the bone of the breast and letting the long neck dangle. Then, catching it by the leg, she raised it suddenly above her head and brought down the bleeding body on the boy's back, in blow after blow, spattering the blood all over his face and his hands, over his clothes, and over the white dust of the rows around him.
"How dare you lie to me?"
she screamed, gasping between the blows.
"You saw the hen. I know you saw it. You stopped whistling. You called out. We were watching you. We saw..."
She turned upon the old man.
"Isn't that right?"
she demanded.
"He saw the hen, didn't he? He saw it."
"It looked that way,"
said the old man uncertainly, his eye on the dangling fowl in the widow's hand.
"There you are,"
said the widow. She threw the hen down on the road.
"You saw the hen in front of you on the road, as plain as you see it now,"
she accused.
"But you wouldn't stop to save it, because you were in too big a hurry home to fill your belly. Isn't that so?"
"No, Mother, no. I saw her all right, but it was too late to do anything."
"He admits it now that he saw it,"
said the widow, turning and nodding triumphantly at the onlookers, who had gathered at the sound of the shouting.
"I never denied seeing it,"
said the boy, appealing to the onlookers as to his judges.
"He doesn't deny it,"
screamed the widow.
"He stands there, as brazen as you like, and admits for the world to hear that he saw the hen and rode over it without a thought."
"But what else could I do?"
said the boy, throwing out his hand, appealing to the crowd now, and now appealing to the widow.
"If I'd put on the brakes going down the hill at such a speed, I would have been put over the handlebars."
"And what harm would that have done you?"
screamed the widow.
"I often saw you taking a toss when you were wrestling with Jimmy Mack, and I heard no complaints afterward, although your elbows and knees would be running blood and your face scraped like a gridiron."
She turned to the crowd.
That's as true as God. I often saw him come in with his nose spouting blood like a pump, and one eye closed as tight as the eye of a corpse. My hand was often stiff for a week, sopping out wet clothes to put poultices on him and try to bring his face back to rights again.
She swung back to Packy again.
You're not afraid of a fall when you go climbing trees, are you? You're not afraid to go up on the roof after a cat, are you? Oh, there's more in this than you want me to know. I can see that. You killed that hen on purpose. That's what I believe. You're tired of going to school. You want to get out of going away to college. That's it. You think if you kill the few poor hens we have, there will be no money in the box when the time comes to pay for books and classes. That's it.
Packy began to redden.
It's late in the day for me to be thinking of things like that, he said. It's long ago. I should have started those tricks if that was the way I felt. But it's not true. I want to go to college. The reason I was coming down the hill so fast was to tell you that I got the scholarship. The teacher told me as I was leaving the schoolhouse. That's why I was pedaling so hard. That's why I was whistling. That's why I was waving my hand. Didn't you see me waving my hand from once I came in sight at the top of the hill?
The widow's hands fell to her sides. The wind of words died down within her and left her flat and limp. She didn't know what to say. She could feel the neighbors staring at her. She wished they were gone away about their business. She wanted to throw out her arms to the boy, to drag him against her heart and hug him like a small child. But she thought of how the crowd would look at each other and nod and snigger. A ewe lamb. She didn't want to satisfy them. If she gave in to her feelings now, they would know how much she had been counting on his getting the scholarship. She wouldn't please them. She wouldn't satisfy them. She looked at Packy, and when she saw him standing there before her, spattered with the furious feathers and crude blood of the dead hen, she felt a fierce disappointment for the boy's own disappointment, and a fierce resentment against him for killing the hen on this day of all days and spoiling the great news of his success. Her mind was in confusion. She stared at the blood on his face, and all at once it seemed as if the blood was a bad omen of the future that was for him. Disappointment, fear, resentment, and above all defiance raised themselves within her like screeching animals. She looked from Packy to the onlookers. Scholarship! Scholarship! She sneered, putting as much derision as she could into her voice and expression. I suppose you think you are a great fellow now. I suppose you think you are independent now. I suppose you think you can go off with yourself now and look down on your poor slave of a mother who scraped and sweated for you with her cabbages and her hens. I suppose you think to yourself that it doesn't matter now whether the hens are alive or dead. Is that the way? Well, let me tell you this. You are not as independent as you think. The scholarship may pay for your books and your teacher's fees, but who will pay for your clothes? Aha, you forgot that, didn't you? She put her hands on her hips. Packy hung his head. He no longer appealed to the gawking neighbors. They might have been able to save him from blows, but he knew enough about life to know that no one could save him from shame. The widow's heart burned at sight of his shamed face, as her heart burned with grief, but her temper too burned fiercer and fiercer, and she came to a point at which nothing could quell the blaze till it had burned itself out. "Who'll buy your suits?" she yelled. "Who'll buy your boots?" She paused to think of more humiliating accusations. "Who'll buy your breeches?" She paused again, and her teeth bent against each other. What would wound deepest? What shame could she drag upon him?
Who'll buy your nightshirts, or will you sleep in your skin?
The neighbors laughed at that, and the tension was broken. The widow herself laughed. She held her sides and laughed, and as she laughed, everything seemed to take on a newer, simpler significance. Things were not as bad as they seemed a moment before. She wanted Packy to laugh, too. She looked at him. But as she looked at Packy, her heart turned cold with a strange new fear.
"Get into the house," she said, giving him a push ahead of her. She wanted him safe under her own roof. She wanted to get him away from the gaping neighbors.
She hated them, man, woman, and child. She felt that if they had not been there, things would have been different, and she wanted to get away from the sight of the blood on the road. She wanted to mash a few potatoes and make a bit of potato cake for Packy. That would comfort him. He loved that. Packy hardly touched the food, and even after he had washed and scrubbed himself, there were stains of blood turning up in the most unexpected places. Behind his ears, under his fingernails, inside the cuff of his sleeve.
"Put on your good clothes,"
said the widow, making a great effort to be gentle. But her manners had become as twisted and as hard as the branches of the trees across the road from her, and even the kindly offer she made sounded harsh. The boy sat on the chair in a slumped position that kept her nerves on edge and set up a further conflict of irritation and love in her heart. She hated to see him slumping there in the chair, not asking to go outside the door, but still she was uneasy whenever he as much as looked in the direction of the door. She felt safe while he was under the roof, inside the lintel, under her eyes. The next day she went in to wake him for school, but his room was empty. His bed had not been slept in, and when she ran out into the yard she called him everywhere and there was no answer. She ran up and down. She called at the houses of neighbors, but he was not in any house, and she thought she could hear sniggering behind her in each house that she left as she ran to another one. He wasn't in the village, nor in the town. The schoolmaster said that she should let the police have a description of him. He said he never met a boy as sensitive as Packy. A boy like that took strange notions into his head from time to time. The police did their best, but there was no news of Packy that night. A few days later, there was a letter saying that he was well. He asked his mother to notify the master that he would not be coming back, so that some other boy could claim the scholarship. He said that he would send the price of the hen as soon as he made some money. Another letter in a few weeks said that he had got a job on a trawler and that he would not be able to write very often, but that he would put aside some of his pay every week and send it to his mother whenever he got into port. He said that he wanted to pay her back for all she had done for him. He gave no address. He kept his promise about the money, but he never gave any address when he wrote. And so the people may have let their thoughts run on as they sat by the fire with the widow many a night, listening to her complaining voice saying the same thing over and over. Why did he put the price of an old hen above the price of his own life? And it is possible that their version of the story has a certain element of truth about it, too. Perhaps all our actions have this double quality about them, this possibility of alternative, and that it is only by careful watching and absolute sincerity that we follow the path that is destined for us. And no matter how tragic that may be, it is better than the tragedy we bring upon ourselves. Pulitzer Prize-winning author of our next story, Catherine Ann Porter, was born in Indian Creek, Texas in 1890. Although many of her works deal with dark themes, such as death and betrayal, one we are presenting today, entitled Rope, is a bit more upbeat. Her only education beyond grammar school was 1 year at the Thomas School in San Antonio. Other works include Pale Horse, Pale Rider, and Ship of Fools. Married and divorced 4 times, she never had children. Catherine died September 18, 1980, and is buried next to her mother at Indian Creek. On the third day after they moved to the country, he came walking back from the village, carrying a basket of groceries and a 24-yard coil of rope. She came out to meet him, wiping her hands on her green smock. Her hair was tumbled, her nose was scarlet with sunburn. He told her that already she looked like a born countrywoman. His gray flannel shirt stuck to him, his heavy shoes were dusty. She assured him he looked like a rural character in a play. Had he brought the coffee? She had been waiting all day long for coffee. They had forgot it when they ordered at the store the first day. Gosh, no, he hadn't. Lord, now he'd have to go back. Yes, he would if it killed him. He thought, though, he had everything else. She reminded him it was only because he didn't drink coffee himself. If he did, he would remember it quick enough. Suppose they ran out of cigarettes. Then she saw the rope. What was it for? Well, he thought it might do to hang clothes on or something. Naturally, she asked him if he thought they were going to run a laundry. They already had a 50-foot line hanging right before his eyes. Why, hadn't he noticed it really? It was a blot on the landscape to her. He thought there were a lot of things a rope might come in handy for. She wanted to know what, for instance. He thought a few seconds, but nothing occurred. They could wait and see, couldn't they? You need all sorts of strange odds and ends around a place in the country. She said yes, that was so, but she thought just at that time when every penny counted, it seemed funny to buy more rope. That was all. She hadn't meant anything else. She hadn't just seen, not at first, why he felt it was necessary. Well, thunder, he had bought it because he wanted to, and that was all there was to it. She thought that was reason enough and couldn't understand why he hadn't said so at first. Undoubtedly it would be useful, 24 yards of rope. There were hundreds of things. She couldn't think of any at the moment, but it would come in, of course. As he had said, things always did in the country. But she was a little disappointed about the coffee. And, oh, look, look, look at the eggs! Oh, my, they're all running! What had he put on top of them? Hadn't he known that eggs mustn't be squeezed? Squeezed! Who had squeezed them, he wanted to know. What a silly thing to say. He had simply brought them along in the basket with the other things. If they broke, it was the grocer's fault. He should know better than to put heavy things on top of eggs. She believed it was the rope. That was the heaviest thing in the pack. She saw him plainly when he came in from the road. The rope was a big package on top of everything. He desired the whole wide world to witness that this was not a fact. He had carried the rope in one hand and the basket in the other, and what was the use of her having eyes if that was the best they could do for her? Well, anyhow, she could see one thing plain. No eggs for breakfast. They'd have to scramble them now for supper. It was too damned bad. She had planned to have steak for supper. No ice. Meat wouldn't keep. He wanted to know why she couldn't finish breaking the eggs in a bowl and set them in a cool place. Cool place! If he could find one for her, she'd be glad to set them there. Well, then, it seemed to him, they might very well cook the meat at the same time they cooked the eggs, and then warm up the meat for tomorrow. The idea simply choked her. Warmed over meat, when they might as well have had it fresh. Second best in scraps and makeshifts, even to the meat. He rubbed her shoulder a little. It doesn't really matter so much, does it, darling? Sometimes when they were playful, he would rub her shoulder, and she would arch and purr. This time she hissed and almost clawed. He was getting ready to say they could surely manage somehow when she turned on him and said, if he told her they could manage somehow, she would certainly slap his face. He swallowed the words red hot. His face burned. He picked up the rope and started to put it on the top shelf. She would not have it on the top shelf. The jars and tins belonged there. Positively, she would not have the top shelf cluttered up with a lot of rope. She had borne all the clutter she meant to bear in the flattened town. There was space here at last, and she meant to keep things in order. Well, in that case, he wanted to know what the hammer and nails were doing up there. And why had she put them there when she knew very well he needed that hammer and those nails upstairs to fix the window sashes? She simply slowed down everything and made double work on the place with her insane habit of changing things around and hiding them. She was sure she begged his pardon, and if she had had any reason to believe he was going to fix the sashes this summer, she would have left the hammer and nails right where he put them, in the middle of the bedroom floor where they could step on them in the dark. And now, if he didn't clear the whole mess out of there, she would throw them down the well. Oh, all right, all right. Could he put them in the closet? Naturally not. There were brooms and mops and dustpans in the closet. And why couldn't he find a place for his rope outside her kitchen? Had he stopped to consider there were 7 godforsaken rooms in the house and only 1 kitchen? He wanted to know what of it, and did she realize she was making a complete fool of herself? And what did she take him for, a 3-year-old idiot? The whole trouble with her was she needed something weaker than she was to heckle and tyrannize over. He wished to God now they had a couple of children she could take it out on. Maybe he'd get some rest. Her face changed at this. She reminded him he had forgot the coffee, and he had bought a worthless piece of rope. And when she thought of all the things they actually needed to make the place even decently fit to live in, well, she could cry, that was all. She looked so forlorn, so lost and despairing, he couldn't believe it was only a piece of rope that was causing all the racket. What was the matter, for God's sake? Oh, would he please hush and go away, and stay away if he could for 5 minutes? By all means, yes, he would. He'd stay indefinitely if she wished. Lord, yes, there was nothing he'd like better than to clear out and never come back. She couldn't for the life of her see what was holding him then. It was a swell time. Here she was, stuck miles from a railroad, with a half-empty house on her hands and not a penny in her pocket, and everything on earth to do. It seemed the God-sent moment for him to get out from under. She was surprised he hadn't stayed in town as it was until she had come out and done the work and got things straightened out. It was his usual trick. It appeared to him that this was going a little far, just a touch out of bounds if she didn't mind his saying so. Why the hell had he stayed in town the summer before? To do a half dozen extra jobs to get the money he had sent her. That was it. She knew perfectly well they couldn't have done it otherwise. She had agreed with him at the time, and that was the only time, so help him, he had ever left her to do anything by herself. Oh, he could tell that to his great-grandmother. She had her notion of what had kept him in town, considerably more than a notion if he wanted to know. So she was going to bring all that up again, was she? Well, she could just think what she pleased. He was tired of explaining. It may have looked funny, but he had simply got hooked in. And what could he do? It was impossible to believe that she was going to take it seriously. Yes, yes, she knew how it was with a man. If he was left by himself for a minute, some woman was certain to kidnap him, and naturally he couldn't hurt her feelings by refusing. Well, what was she raving about? Did she forget she had told him those 2 weeks alone in the country were the happiest she had known for 4 years? And how long had they been married when she said that? All right, shut up, if she thought that hadn't stuck in his craw. She hadn't meant that she was happy because she was away from him. She meant she was happy getting the devilish house nice and ready for him. That was what she had meant, and now look, bringing up something she had said a year ago simply to justify himself for forgetting her coffee and breaking the eggs and buying a wretched piece of rope they couldn't afford. She really thought it was time to drop the subject, and now she wanted only 2 things in the world. She wanted him to get the rope from underfoot and go back to the village and get her coffee. And if he could remember it, he might bring a metal mitt for the skillets and 2 more curtain rods. And if there were any rubber gloves in the village, her hands were simply raw, and a bottle of milk of magnesia from the drugstore. He looked out at the dark blue afternoon sweltering on the slopes and mopped his forehead and sighed heavily and said, if only she could wait a minute for anything, he was going back. He had said so, hadn't he, the very instant he found he had overlooked it. Oh, yes, well, run along. She was going to wash the windows. The country was so beautiful. She doubted they'd have a moment to enjoy it. He meant to go, but he could not until he had said that if she was such a hopeless melancholic, she might see that this was only for a few days. Couldn't she remember anything pleasant about the summers? Hadn't they ever had any fun? She hadn't time to talk about it, and now would he please not leave that rope lying around for her to trip on? He picked it up, somehow it had toppled off the table, and walked out with it under his arm. Was he going this minute? He certainly was. She thought so. Sometimes it seemed to her he had second sight about the precisely perfect moment to leave her ditched. She had meant to put the mattresses out to sun. If they put them out this minute, they would get at least 3 hours. He must have heard her say something that morning she meant to put them out. So, of course, he would walk off and leave her to it. She supposed he thought the exercise would do her good. Well, he was merely going to get her coffee. A 4-mile walk for 2 pounds of coffee was ridiculous, but he was perfectly willing to do it. The habit was making a wreck of her, but if she wanted to wreck herself, then there was nothing he could do about it. If he thought it was coffee that was making a wreck of her, she congratulated him. He must have a damned easy conscience. Conscience or no conscience, he didn't see why the mattresses couldn't very well wait until tomorrow. And anyhow, for God's sake, were they living in the house, or were they going to let the house ride them to death? She paled at this. Her face grew livid about the mouth. She looked quite dangerous, and reminded him that housekeeping was no more her work than it was his. She had other work to do as well, and when did he think she was going to find time to do it at this rate? Was she going to start on that again? She knew as well as he did that his work brought in the regular money. Hers was only occasional. If they depended on what she made, and she might as well get straight on this question once and for all. That was positively not the point. The question was, when both of them were working on their time, was there going to be a division of the housework, or wasn't there? She merely wanted to know. She had to make her plans. Why, he thought that was all arranged. It was understood that he was to help. Hadn't he always, in summers? Hadn't he, though? Oh, just hadn't he. And when, and where, and doing what? Lord, what an uproarious joke! It was such a very uproarious joke that her face turned slightly purple, and she screamed with laughter. She laughed so hard she had to sit down, and finally a rush of tears spurted from her eyes and poured down into the lifted corners of her mouth. He dashed towards her, and dragged her up to her feet and tried to pour water on her head. The dipper hung by a string on a nail, and he broke it loose. Then he tried to pump water with one hand, while she struggled in the other. So he gave it up and shook her instead. She wrenched away, crying out for him to take his rope and go to hell. She had simply given him up, and ran. He heard her high-heeled bedroom slippers clattering and stumbling on the stairs. He went out around the house and into the lane. He suddenly realized he had a blister on his heel, and his shirt felt as if it were on fire. Things broke so suddenly you didn't know where you were. She could work herself into a fury about simply nothing. She was terrible. Damn it, not an ounce of reason. You might as well talk to a sieve as that woman when she got going. Damned if he'd spend his life humoring her. Well, what to do now? He would take back the rope and exchange it for something else. Things accumulated. Things were mountainous. You couldn't move them or sort them out or get rid of them. They just lay and rotted around. He'd take it back. Hell, why should he? He wanted it. What was it anyhow? A piece of rope. Imagine anybody caring more about a piece of rope than about a man's feelings. What earthly right had she to say a word about it? He remembered all the useless, meaningless things she bought for herself. Why? Because I wanted it. That's why. He stopped and selected a large stone by the road. He would put the rope behind it. He would put it in the toolbox when he got back. He heard enough about it to last him a lifetime. When he came back, she was leaning against the post box beside the road waiting. It was pretty late. The smell of broiled steak floated nose high in the cooling air. Her face was young and smooth and fresh-looking. Her unmanageable, funny black hair was all on end. She waved to him from a distance, and he speeded up. She called out that supper was ready and waiting. Was he starved? You bet he was starved. Here was the coffee. He waved it at her. She looked at his other hand. What was that he had there? Well, it was the rope again. He stopped short. He had meant to exchange it, but forgot. She wanted to know why he should exchange it, if it was something he really wanted. Wasn't the air sweet now? And wasn't it fine to be here? She walked beside him with one hand hooked into his leather belt. She pulled and jostled him a little as he walked and leaned against him. He put his arm clear around her and patted her stomach. They exchanged wary smiles. Coffee. Coffee for the Ootsum Wootsums. He felt as if he were bringing her a beautiful present. He was a love she firmly believed, and if she had had her coffee in the morning, she wouldn't have behaved so funny. There was a whippoorwill still coming back, imagine, clear out of season, sitting in the crabapple tree calling all by himself. Maybe his girl stood him up. Maybe she did. She hoped to hear him once more. She loved whippoorwills. He knew how she was, didn't he? Sure. He knew how she was. Ian Frazier was born in 1951 in Cleveland, Ohio. While attending Harvard University, he was on the staff of the Harvard Lampoon. After graduation, he worked briefly in Chicago as a magazine writer before joining the staff of the New Yorker magazine, where he wrote both nonfiction articles and humor pieces. He has published many nonfiction books, including Great Plains and the autobiographical Family. The following short story, Tomorrow's Bird, is one of Frazier's fine humor pieces. Since May, I've been working for the Crows, and so far it's the best job I've ever had. I kind of fell into it by a combination of preparedness and luck. I'd been casting around a bit, looking for a new direction in my career, and one afternoon, when I was out on my walk, I happened to see some crows fly by. One of them landed on a telephone wire just above my head. I looked at him for a moment, and then on impulse I made a noise with my teeth and lips. He seemed to like that. I saw his tail make a quick upward bobbing motion at the sound. Encouraged, I made the noise again, and again his tail bobbed. He looked at me closely with one eye, then turned his beak and looked at me with the other, meanwhile readjusting his feet on the wire. After a few minutes, he cawed and flew off to join his companions. I had a good feeling I couldn't put into words. Basically, I thought the meeting had gone well, and as it turned out, I was right. When I got home, there was a message from the Crows saying I had the job. The first interview proved indicative of the Crows' business style. They are very informal and relaxed, unlike their public persona, and mostly they leave me alone. I am given a general direction of what they want done, but the specifics of how to do it are up to me. For example, the Crows have long been unhappy about public misperceptions of them, that they raid other birds' nests, drive songbirds away, eat garbage and dead things, can't sing, etc., all of which are completely untrue once you know them. My first task was to take these misperceptions and turn them into a more positive image. I decided the crows needed a slogan that emphasized their strengths as a species. The slogan I came up with was, "Crows, we want to be your only bird." I told this to the crows. They loved it, and we have been using it ever since. Crows speak a dialect of English, rather like that of the remote hill people of the Alleghenies. If you're not accustomed to it, it can be hard to understand. In their formal speech, they are as measured and clear as a radio announcer from the Midwest, though, as I say, they are seldom formal with me. For everyday needs, of course, they caw. Their unit of money is the empty soda bottle, which trades at a rate of about 20 to the dollar. In the recent years of economic boom, the crows have quietly amassed great power. With investment capital based on their nationwide control of everything that gets run over on the roads, they have bought a number of major companies. Pepsi-Cola is now owned by the crows, as well as Knight Ridder Newspapers and the company that makes Tombstone Frozen Pizzas. The New York Metropolitan Opera is now wholly crow-owned. In order to stay competitive, as most people know, the crows recently merged with the Ravens. This was done not only for reasons of growth, but also to better serve those millions who live and work near crows. In the future, both crows and ravens will be known by the group name of crows. So if you see a bird and wonder which it is, you don't have to waste any time. Officially and legally, it's a crow. The net result of this, of course, is that now there are a lot more crows, which is exactly what the crows want. Studies they've sponsored show there could be anywhere from 10 to 1,000 times more crows than there already are, with no strain on carrying capacity. A healthy increase in crow numbers would make basic services, like calling loudly outside your bedroom window at 6 in the morning, available to all. In this area, as in many others, the crows are thinking very long term. If more people in the future get a chance to know crows as I have done, they are in for a real treat. Because I must say, the crows have been absolutely wonderful to me. I like them, not just as highly profitable business associates, but as friends. Their aggressive side, admittedly quite strong in disputes with scarlet tanagers, etc., has been nowhere in evidence around me. I could not wish for any companions more charming. The other day I was having lunch with an important crow in the park, me sipping from a drinking fountain while he ate peanuts taken from a squirrel. In between sharp downward raps of his bill on the peanut shell to poke it open, he drew me out with seemingly artless questions. Sometimes the wind would push the shell to one side and he would steady it with one large foot while continuing the raps with his beak. And all the while he kept up his attentive questioning, making me feel that, business considerations aside, he was truly interested in what I had to say. Crows, we want to be your only bird. I think this slogan is worth repeating because there's a lot behind it. Of course, crows don't literally want or expect to be the only species of bird left on the planet. They admire and enjoy other kinds of birds and even hope that there will still be some remaining in limited numbers out of doors as well as in zoos and museums. But in terms of daily usage, the crows hope that you will think of them first when you're looking for those quality of life intangibles usually associated with birds. Singing, for example. Crows actually can sing, and beautifully too. However, so far they have not been given any chance. In the future, with fewer other birds around, they feel that they will be. Whether they're good-naturedly harassing an owl caught out in daylight, or carrying bits of sticks and used gauze bandage in their beaks to make their colorful, free-form nests, or simply landing on the sidewalk in front of you with their characteristic double hop, the crows have become a part of the fabric of our days. When you had your first kiss, the crows were there, flying around nearby. They were cawing overhead at your college graduation and worrying a hamburger wrapper through the wire mesh of a trash container in front of the building
when you went in for your first job interview, and flapping past the door of the hospital where you held your firstborn child. The crows have always been with us, and they promise that by growing the species at a predicted rate of 17% a year, in the future they'll be around even more. The crows aren't the last Siberian tigers, and they don't pretend to be. They're not interested in being part of anybody's dying tradition. But then, how many of us deal with Siberian tigers on a regular basis? Usually, the non-tech stuff we deal with, besides humans, is squirrels, pigeons, raccoons, rats, mice, and a few kinds of bugs. The crows are confident enough to claim that they will be able to compete effectively with even these familiar and well-entrenched providers. Indeed, they have already begun to displace pigeons in the category of walking around under park benches with chewing gum stuck to their feet. Scampering nervously in attics, sneaking through pet doors, and gnawing little holes in things are all in the crows' expansion plans. I would not have taken this job if I did not believe strongly and deeply in the crows myself. And I do. I could go on and on about the crows' generosity, taste in music, sense of family values, the buddy system they invented to use against other birds, the work they do for the Shriners, and more. But they're paying me a lot of bottles to say this. I can't expect everybody to believe me. I do ask, if you're unconvinced, that you take this simple test. Next time you're looking out a window or driving in a car, notice if there's a crow in sight. Then multiply that one crow by lots and lots of crows, and you'll get an idea of what the next years will bring. In the bird department, no matter what, the future is going to be almost all crows almost all the time. That's just a fact. So why not just accept it and learn to appreciate it, as so many of us have already? The crows are going to influence our culture and our world in beneficial ways we can't even imagine today. Much of what they envision I am not yet at liberty to disclose, but I can tell you that it is magnificent. They are going to be birds like we've never seen. In their dark, jewel-like eyes burns an ambition to be more and better and to fly around all over the place constantly. They're smart, they're driven, and they're coming at us. The crows, let's get ready to welcome tomorrow's only bird. This brings us to the end of an hour of short stories, which originated from NTRB, North Texas Radio for the Blind, Dallas. For more about this program, visit www.anhourofshortstories.com. I'm John Pritchett. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is a public service announcement from the Massachusetts Association for the Blind. The Massachusetts Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired provides assistive technology training for persons with visual impairments. If you or a family member are interested in receiving one-on-one specialized training, please contact 617-991-7073 or email atcenter@mabcommunity.org.
What's your vision?
My vision's 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye and zero vision in the left eye.
20/200 at best on my left eye, and on my right eye, I cannot see.
No, I mean, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
My vision is employment opportunities for all, including people with disabilities.
My vision is for all of my students to dream big.
That he become fully independent.
For my patients to live their best lives.
What's your vision?
What's your vision?
What is your vision?
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, our vision is clear. We believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.